Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Settlement Music School Executive Director Robert Capanna. The school celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Walnut Street Theatre as it stages Arthur Miller's The Price. The show features renowned film actor Robert Prosky, a Philadelphia native. Susan Lewis explores the Reading Public Museum, which over the course of its 100 plus years has grown from a science collection into a multidisciplinary museum with galleries for art and artifacts from all over the world. And David Patrick Stearns on Florence Foster Jenkins. The early 20th century Manhattan socialite with the famous lack of musical talent is portrayed by Anne Crum in a new production at the Media Theatre. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In 1908, Janet Selig Frank and Blanche Wolfe Cohn started a voluntary social services center for newly arrived immigrants in a row home in the Southwark section of Philadelphia. As well as providing an employment bureau, classes in Italian, sewing lessons, and a vocational guidance program, the center offered piano lessons. So popular was this musical instruction that within 6 years the center had become a fully-fledged music school with 250 students. 3 years later, it moved to a purpose-built facility paid for by Mary Louise Curtis Bock, who would later found the Curtis Institute of Music to serve more advanced students. Thus was born Settlement Music School, and 100 years later, it has branches in 6 settlements and a student body numbering more than 15,000. Over the past century, many of Settlement's alumni have gone on to successful careers in music, but also in many other fields. Now, as part of the school's centenary celebrations, comes the Settlement 100, a list of 100 exemplary Settlement alumni. The school has so far released 60 of the names. The final 40 will be announced at a ceremony on Tuesday. Earlier this week, I spoke with Robert Capanna, who's been the school's executive director for more than a quarter century. How much, to your estimation, of the original philosophy of Settlement Music School is still a part of the operating manual today?
You know, I often say to people that I think that if you were to look at the program of the school in, 1910 and look at the program of the school today, you would see essentially the same thing. The only thing that we don't do that was originally done is that we no longer give baths and sewing classes and English lessons.
And why is that? Society has changed radically, though, and people's interest and approaches to music has also changed. We constantly hear about, young people today, it's all about video games and the internet and instant messaging, and they don't have the concentration or the focus to dedicate themselves to a musical instrument. Discuss.
Well, I understand that perception as a kind of grand view of American culture. But I don't have any actual experience of it in terms of the students at Settlement Music School. And in fact, my experience has been just the contrary. I have been with the school now for 31 years, which is a reasonable period of time in which to have some perspective. And when I came, there were many fewer students at the school because we had less capacity. The level of the students was much less sophisticated and much less advanced than it is today. And the breadth of the student body was certainly no greater than it is today. So I see higher achievement by the best kids, broader involvement by all kinds of people, and deeper engagement by students of all ages. I mean, another huge difference between 30 years ago and today is that today we have a very significant population of seniors and adults, which was much, much less 30 years ago. So I just don't buy it, actually, because I think that we have conflated in our minds interest with purchasing. And it is true that organizations that sell tickets or sell records or sell anything related to serious art music are having a difficult time because of all of these changes in the environment, the society, consumers, all that stuff. But I don't think that that is a reflection of people's interests in acquiring skills or participating in activities.
You say 31 years with Settlement. You've been at the helm, the anniversary passed rather quietly last year, for a quarter of the entire existence of the school. You've been here, you've been at the helm for 25 years.
Yeah, that's true.
When you started, how did you imagine, or what did you think you needed to do, and how was the reality different from what you thought it would be?
Well, I remember very clearly, very shortly after getting the job, thinking to myself, oh my God, am I going to be the guy who gets to preside over the decline of Settlement Music School? Because I just had this horrible vision, you know, that money was going to get even tighter and situations would get grimmer. But fortunately, that didn't happen. And I think that the kind of couple of things that I really tried to focus on were, first of all, shifting the burden of subsidy of the school's program from the faculty, who are at that point wildly underpaid, to a broader community and a bigger constituency of potential donors. And I think we have been able to do that over the years. The faculty at Settlement Music School are still not fabulously paid by any means, but you no longer have this feeling that, you know, they're like toiling in some grim, dark place so that the school can do what it does.
I mean, your tenure here has also coincided with the trend in the philanthropic community towards the arts and towards education, which hasn't been unhelpful, I imagine.
Right. There certainly has been. I think there have been two trends that are positive. There have been many trends, and they're not all positive. But two of the positive ones are that a number of pretty significant philanthropies have become more objectively oriented in terms of evaluating their grantees. And in an objective evaluation process, Settlement Music School always does very well because we have lots of metrics and we have lots of results and we have broad buy-in and all those positive things. The other trend, too, has been towards a broader recognition of the role that arts education can play in an average person's life, so that the focus isn't entirely on talent, but rather on the value for everybody of participating in the arts. And, of course, that's very central to Settlement's mission.
Let's talk about the focal point, I guess, of the 100-year celebration, which is the Settlement 100. I'm thinking that the Curtis Institute, or places that have a long and storied history, would have difficulty in finding 100 great alumni. How difficult was it to find 100 great former students of Settlement?
Well, you know, it was not at all hard. In fact, the hard part was figuring out how to limit it to 100. Because our goal was really to find 100 people, many of whom had remarkable achievements, but some of whom just had terrific stories and were interesting kind of twists on how a life informed by music can turn out. This is definitely not the list of the 100 most important people to Settlement Music School, because the list doesn't include a number of very key staff, board, and faculty members who over the years shaped the school in significant ways. But it does, you know, when you get done looking at it, turn out to involve a huge number of people who have achieved a great deal, a Nobel Prize winner, you know, a MacArthur Award winner, several Pulitzer Prize winners, Emmy winners, you know. It's kind of fun.
Settlement Music School Executive Director Robert Capanna. The school kicks off celebrations of its centenary on Tuesday with a ceremony to announce the final 40 names on the Settlement 100 Roll of Honor. Throughout the year, the school will continue the celebrations with recitals and concerts by current and past pupils, lectures, an open house at its main branch, and a gala celebration in May. The festivities end in December with a live lunchtime concert to be broadcast on WRTI.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
40 years ago, Arthur Miller's play The Price was tried out at the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia before moving on to Broadway. This week, the legendary playwright's drama returns to the Walnut stage, featuring a veteran Philadelphia-born actor and his two sons. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the family of performers are no strangers to Miller's 1968 play.
Though people often don't recognize 77-year-old Robert Prosky by name, the two-time Tony Award nominee has a face that's very familiar. He's been in over 200 Broadway and regional theater productions, along with dozens of films and TV shows, like Dead Man Walking, Mrs. Doubtfire, The Natural, and Hill Street Blues. The latest show at the Walnut marks Prosky's fourth production of The Price, and that the play is opening in the theater this Wednesday is largely to his credit. With a vacation home in Cape May, New Jersey since 1970, several years ago, Prosky came to Cape May Stage's artistic director, Michael Carlton, with the idea of producing The Price, a play the Washington, D.C.-based actor had, at the time, performed twice before. He proposed that he and his sons, John and Andy Prosky, who are also actors, be in the show.
I thought, well, it would be nice to bring the whole family together. You know, John from the coast and Andy from New York and the grandsons and everything else to live in this Victorian monstrosity that we have and do the play at the Cape May Stage. And it worked out very well.
So well, in fact, that Robert Prosky started to look for other theaters in which to perform the work. With a longtime desire to finally perform in his native Philadelphia, he was born and raised in Manayunk. He wrote letters to several local theater companies inviting them to consider staging the play with the Proskys. The Walnut's producing artistic director, Bernard Tavard, went down the shore and, having seen the show, decided to include it in his 2008 season. One of Arthur Miller's later works, The Price, tells the story of two estranged brothers, Walter and Victor, who after 16 years are reunited to sell off their late father's possessions to a furniture dealer, Gregory Solomon.
Well, we will talk about it.
No, no, Vic. You've earned it. It's yours.
How have I earned it? You take your share.
John and Andy Prosky play brothers Walter and Victor Franz, with their father Robert Prosky as the appraiser, Gregory Solomon, in a drama that Temple University Theater's artistic director, Doug Wager, says demonstrates the strength of Arthur Miller, one of the greatest American playwrights.
Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill are the sort of classic modern American triumvirate of playwriting. Miller, I think, more than either of them, was far more engaged in social commentary in his work.
As the brothers in The Price battle over past decisions and memories, Wager says Miller's play deals with a paradox of the American dream.
Which is that all men are created equal in America and have equal opportunity, but that is an equal opportunity to climb over one another to get to the top. Be successful, be ambitious, regardless of your relationships to other human beings.
Doug Wager's familiarity with both The Price and the Prosky family runs deep. As artistic director for most of the 1990s at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., Wager produced Robert Prosky's first stab at the play. He says today there couldn't be a better fit for the Proskys to do a show together, given their respective ages. Wager says Robert, in particular, who first played the character of Gregory Solomon 15 years ago, is now closer to his character's age. According to Robert Prosky, Solomon provides much of the play's comic relief, one reason he keeps returning to the character.
I love the role. It's one of Miller's great characters. It's like Miller all of a sudden became Neil Simon. He's a funny, marvelous, warm character, but he's also very wise. There's a great deal of depth to it. That's where it's different than Neil Simon.
Having performed The Price a year and a half ago in Cape May, Prosky's sons are also returning to the play with the Walnut Street production. Director of both the Cape May and Philadelphia incarnations, Michael Carlton, says that while it would be easy for all the actors to rest on their laurels and stick with the same acting choices from Cape May, they continue to create and find new approaches to the work.
I think we got a better show than we had in Cape May because they've had a year and a half to gestate on it and think about it and grow into these roles.
Carlton says having such experienced actors, three of whom happen to go by the last name of Prosky, helps make The Walnut's Price a very solid production. But if John and Andy Prosky had taken their father's advice years ago, the show wouldn't be happening. Robert Prosky says he discouraged his sons from becoming actors.
It's a very hard life. Most people don't succeed. You get to be 40, 45, and what have you done with your life? And you're not working. You live with constant rejection. That's tough. But it also, the one thing it is not a boring life. I couldn't tell them that.
The fulfillment that Robert Prosky and his sons have long found with acting evidently makes the price of pursuing a career with so many uncertainties worth it. Meanwhile, the three continue to take advantage of the stability afforded to them by working as a trio. After the Philadelphia run, they will next stage The Price for a month at Theater J in Washington, D.C.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Price is at the Walnut Street Theater through March 2nd. Settled in 1743, Reading, Pennsylvania has, over the years, been known for its iron production in the 18th century and its part in the Pennsylvania and Reading Railroad in the 19th. Today, it's a destination for outlet shoppers and fans of the minor league Reading Phillies. But there's also the Reading Public Museum, housed in a gracious Beaux-Arts mansion on a parkland-like 25-acre setting, complete with arboretum, picnic tables along a creek, and on-site planetarium. Many other museums specialize in fine arts, science, or natural history, but as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, this museum takes a more sweeping approach to the natural and man-made creations of the world.
The Reading Public Museum began as a teaching aid, a collection of scientific and historical artifacts put together by an enthusiastic high school teacher who wanted to better engage his students. Dr. Levi Mengel believed that three-dimensional objects that could be touched and examined were more effective teaching tools than textbooks. So he collected things, over 2,000 items from China, Japan, India, the Philippines, and the Central and South American republics, many from the World's Fair of 1904. Museum director and CEO Ronald Roth says this didactic drive continues today.
We call ourselves and refer to ourselves as a dynamic center of lifelong learning.
Although from 1904 to 1911, the collection reflected the scientific bent of the founder, its scope soon expanded.
Dr. Mengel had a local artist at hand who kept saying, you better start putting some art up there. Let's get some art up in the museum. Actually, the original name of the museum was the Reading Public Museum and Art Gallery, because he basically added the art gallery about a decade after the museum was founded.
In 1927, the museum moved from the Reading School District Administration Building to the present site. The planetarium was added in the 1960s, and in 1992, governance was transferred from the school district to a private foundation. Today, the museum's galleries include history, science, fine arts, as well as crafts and culture. Space is also set aside for traveling exhibits in fine arts and science. As an example of the contrasts, the second floor has a French 19th century gallery. One floor down, a science exhibit might be engaging a three-year-old girl, as it was on the day we visited.
And what is your name?
Alia.
Alia is experimenting with a ball and a maze-like structure.
I put it up here.
Part of our educational mission is to really reach out to the community and promote lifelong learning, and that is learning opportunities to people of all ages.
Ann Corso is the Reading Museum's Director of Lifelong Learning, and the museum offers something to appeal to every taste and every stage. Its permanent collections now include 1,100 paintings and 14,000 works on paper. It has galleries devoted to the natural sciences and civilizations from Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. Its American works include paintings by the Pennsylvania Impressionists, as well as what Ronald Roth describes as one of the United States' leading collections of folk art.
This region of Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Montgomery County, Burst County, was really the first flowering of American folk art, beginning in 1750 through about 1860. Our blanket chests, for instance, are among the finest of their kind.
A collection of what's called reverse glass painting, pictures painted on the back of glass, leads to a gallery of sculpture and other works from the museum's growing collection of 20th century art. Downstairs, on the first floor, we can find, among other things, a mummy from Egypt in repose around the corner from a display of armor. On the other side of the central hall is a Native American ceremonial garb known as a ghost dance shirt and leggings. Around that corner is a Latin American gallery.
Reading has a substantial population of Latinos and Hispanics. The pre-Columbian art and the Mayan civilizations, the Aztecs, the Incas, are one of the great fascinating stories of Western Hemisphere civilizations. And so we tell this story to the broader public and as a way, again, to reach out to that part of our community.
The natural science collection includes stuffed wildlife, from birds to bears, and fossils, including one fossil found in Pennsylvania that made international headlines when it was discovered to be an intact impression of a creature approximately 330 million years old, predating the dinosaurs by about 100 million years. Science curator Mike Fiers says it's extremely rare to find this kind of full body cast.
By that I mean the animal laid down into the substrate below it, leaving a body impression. You can actually see its legs, its belly, its tail, its chin.
A short walk across the parking lot is the planetarium, which uses digital technology. Information runs through two computers, and a single projector casts images on the giant dome above the 40-foot room. Director Mark Mezukevich says the system is networked to databases all over the world. New discoveries can be projected in the Reading Planetarium as soon as they're loaded into the overall system.
We updated something actually a couple of weeks ago when they discovered what they call an extrasolar planet. An extrasolar planet is just a fancy way of saying that it's a planet that exists outside of our solar system. There's about 170 of these new planets out there. And once we have the coordinates for where that planet exists, we can actually take you into that space and take you inside the constellation and show you that.
Mezukevich says unlike the old planetariums that projected a static sky, this digital planetarium provides views from multiple perspectives and can zoom in on anything, creating a visual sensation of traveling through space at thousands of light years per second.
It's just literally an atlas of the universe. We can simply go in three dimensions. We have the ability to go to anywhere on the globe and really anywhere in the known universe and show you what the sky, what space looks like from that perspective.
Providing unusual perspectives on the creations of this world as well as beyond may be the Reading Public Museum's greatest strength. Director of Lifelong Learning Ann Corso says the 2007 exhibition, Degas and the Art of Japan, was but one example.
One thing that we can really do well is to bring these sometimes seemingly different cultures and different artistic movements together and to present them in a thoughtful way to the public.
The museum is increasingly thinking of ways to highlight the connections between the disciplines, says Director Roth.
For instance, the butterfly was an important symbol in Latin American pre-Columbian religions, often representing the soul. Well, it turns out we have 75,000 butterflies in our collection because that was Dr. Mengel's expertise. And so at some point, we're probably going to have a conversation with the public about the butterfly and its role, ecological issues related to the South American butterfly. But then again, make some connections to the importance that the butterflies had in terms of the religious practices of some of these early cultures.
In a world where more and more industries, organizations, and people equate specialization with expertise, the Reading Public Museum is somewhat of an anomaly. But in putting everything in one place, it invites visitors to take journeys, whether from art to science, from culture to culture, or from this world into outer space.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Among the special exhibitions now at the Reading Public Museum is a photographic exhibit by Anne Hyman on sea turtles, which runs until April 27th, and an exhibition of pre-Columbian art from the collection of Philadelphia collector Dr. Luther Brady, which runs through March 17th and then returns again in late May. The Media Theatre, a vintage movie palace turned legit theatre, is hosting what might be called an anti-legend, Florence Foster Jenkins. She was the New York Society matron who, at age 76 in 1944, gave a benefit concert at Carnegie Hall that has gone down in history as perhaps the most hilariously awful performance to take place under such visible circumstances. A Broadway play about her life, titled Souvenir, opens on Wednesday in media with the monumentally deluded Jenkins, played by Anne Crum, star of Broadway musicals and daughter of local composer George Crum. During a break in rehearsals this week, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns witnessed soprano Crumb's heroic attempts to sing as badly as possible.
No rhythm, no pitch, no musicality, but a lot of pretension. The folly of Florence Foster Jenkins went way beyond warbling a genteel art song. Now, she thought of herself as a distinguished coloratura soprano, and at a stage in her life when even the greatest singers of that kind would stay safely retired, as opposed to making their Carnegie Hall debut. What came naturally to Jenkins, though, wasn't easy for Judy Kaye, who originated the role on Broadway, or for Anne Crum, who has starred in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Aspects of Love.
Crazy rhythm, here's the doorway. Yes,
A question posed in the first moments of Souvenir by her accompanist, played by Carl Danielson, is what did she hear while singing? Media Theater Artistic Director Jesse Klein believes somehow Jenkins had to have heard Beauty and wouldn't listen to her accompanist when he tried to persuade her from giving public concerts.
And if he had walked out and said, I can't, he says, I can't do this. Well, somebody will.
The question of what did she see? The most famous photo of Florence Foster Jenkins is of her wearing a huge pair of angel wings. Not that she was always in the clouds. For some sections of her concerts, the portly Jenkins dressed as a Russian peasant. Her world of make-believe was indeed multifaceted. As it turns out, she had many reasons for escaping. A little-known period in her life, explored in the excellent Jenkins biographical DVD titled A World of Her Own, is when she lived in Philadelphia, eking out a living as a piano teacher. An arm injury had ended her promising concert pianist career. Her family had temporarily disowned her because of her hasty marriage. The marriage itself failed, and Jenkins had, thanks to her husband, been infected with syphilis. The disease and its treatments apparently left her bald, and perhaps compromised in other ways late in life.
I don't know if it's something that the playwright intended, but there is a time where the language seems a little odd when she expresses that she has nerves and she's getting overwhelmed and she feels a tightness.
The Jenkins legend survives and is on stage in media not merely because of its wacky extravagance, but because she is hardly the only one who so desperately needed to achieve and sustain fame. How many athletes, from swimmer Mark Spitz to boxer Muhammad Ali, have attempted ill-fated comebacks? And movie stars. Late in life, the aging sex goddess Mae West made a rock and roll Christmas album that rivals Florence Foster Jenkins in its accidental humor.
I don't mean on the phone, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. So hurry down the chimney tonight.
The Jenkins legend is strangely haunting. With too much money and not enough meds, any one of us could rent Carnegie Hall for a night, convinced of our own artistry when nobody else is. With reality TV, money or meds need not be part of the equation. After a long day of rehearsals, Anne Crum saw the local Philadelphia telecast of American Idol, and estimated that three-quarters of the people there lacked, how should we say, a clear assessment of their own talent. She phoned me the next day and exclaimed, Florence Foster Jenkins was everywhere. So laugh and laugh well at the Media Theater during the run of Souvenir, but not because you feel superior to the high society matron with so much money and so little voice. Laugh with relief, because at least today, you are not her.
David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Souvenir in Tuesday's Philadelphia Inquirer. The show, which stars Anne Crum as Florence Foster Jenkins, opens Wednesday and runs through February 17th at the Media Theatre on East State Street in Media. And that's our show. Our thanks this week to Tom Miller, Chris Parsons and Michael Anderson. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.